Hello and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Voices of Courage show, the show that inspires you to awaken your inner genius, expand your consciousness, and step into the highest version of yourself. Today, we're diving into one of the most important conversations of our time, the great transformation that is no longer coming. It is here. We're living through a moment in history where artificial intelligence, planetary change, social upheaval, and quantum breakthroughs are reshaping the very fabric of our world. And while most people are reaching, reacting with fear, confusion, or overwhelm, you, my dedicated listeners, are being called to rise to pass the noise and step into your power. You know, transformation isn't something that happens to you. It's something that happens through you and for you when you align with courage, clarity, and wisdom. And today's conversation will show you how to stay grounded, conscious, empowered while everything around you accelerates. So buckle up, because this episode is about reclaiming your sovereignty, activating your courage, and preparing you to lead in a world that is fastly changing. Fastly. I don't know if that's a word. Maybe it is. Anyway, listen, I've got an amazing author today with me. He's a sci-fi author, but you know, sci-fi is so close to reality. And you know, I remember things that were sci-fi when I was growing up, like the Dick Tracy. Some of you wouldn't even know who that is, but my younger audience. But Dick Tracy had this watch that he would talk with. Well, of course, now I have my Apple Watch that goes wherever I am. I can call my wife on it. I can listen to music. I can do all so many things, right? So sci-fi became reality. And today we're fast pacing that, where AI is coming in, robotics are coming to us, they're already here. Actually, everything's already here. It's just going to accelerate over the next few years. So we're going to be talking about how close sci-fi and reality really is. And is it really sci-fi? I don't know. We'll find out about that. I do know this, though. Transformation is not an option. You know, there's a new environment coming. And to be prepared for that, I love reading books that not only make me happy and joyful, but expand my consciousness. And my author today has just that book. So we're going to take a deep dive with this, and let's see where we go. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll have my very special guest on the show, and we'll go from there. All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. Richard Anderson, M. Anderson, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here.
You know, when I saw your bio and I looked at the title of your new book, and I was like, oh, I got to have Richard on the show. I got to pick your brain a little bit, you know, your creativity. For those of you that don't know Richard, he's a alumni of San Jose University with a master's degree in microbiology. Throughout his career, his first book, The Evolution of Life, Big Bang to Space Colonies, has been a dream of his that finally came to fruition. It's backed by years of research to verify the content. Richard's second book, Outbound, Islands in the Void, is that right? Islands in the Void is the first in a series of sci-fi fiction. His first two books are award-winning, and his third book, which we're talking about today, is Outbound, Metamars. And Richard and his wife live in the San Francisco Bay Area and close to their three children and families. I bet you got grandchildren. You got any grandchildren too,
Richard? Oh, yeah. We're attending their Christmas plays, their holiday plays, I should say, soccer games and Tai Chi and so forth.
Well, I've got 12 of them myself, so I can relate, and it's so amazing to be able to have children and then children's children. You know, it's amazing to have those beings in our life.
It's a joy, yes.
It's such a joy. Well, okay, Metamars, right? You know, You know, there's a lot of breakthroughs in AI and biotechnology. You know, space exploration is happening for us. You know, what inspired your novel here to get this out there?
I think my inspiration came from my first book, which was I wanted to gain some order over my understanding of evolution. And so when I ended the book at the prospect of space colonies, that of course led into my first novel, How Would We Actually Live in Space? And why? And why would we live in space? What would be the benefit? And how would that tie in with climate change and the coming disaster that I see and a lot of us see? Of course, then when I finished that book, it left me to move on to Mars. Mars being the most likely planet that we'll colonize if we do at all. So I wanted to address some ideas and how difficult that would be to establish a permanence on Mars, what some of the issues that we'd have to solve, one of them being gravity. So I wanted to tie in my concepts of evolution and how we came to be and how we could possibly survive in space. And essentially, we could only do that by bringing as much Earth with us as we could, as much of our environment that we live in now, bring it with us because we need all elements to survive.
Well, you know, I remember reading a book years ago called The Mars Enigma, and The Mars Enigma was showing pictures of pyramids and what looked like possible colonies years ago on Mars. And it was very interesting. I don't know if if it was just illusion or that really happened. Very possible. I don't know. Have you heard that or known about that?
There's a lot of, I would call them conspiracy theories. There's a lot that has been written in science fiction and fantasy. My books are grounded in science, so
Nice.
I gain my ideas from scientific principles, principles of biology, and then I try to build a story around those actual scientific facts. So in the story Metamars, or the stories in Metamars, I try to, oh, how would we solve the gravity problem? I have several solutions. Whether they're practical or not, I want to be out that not want to, I don't want to raise up children and create.
Yeah, Richard, I'm having a little difficulty hearing you right now. I'm not sure what's going on.
I'll get a little closer to the mic.
That's much better. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so what were you saying there? Because I think we missed that.
So I think we need one of the issues is the most difficult issue is addressing gravity on Mars. So if we gestate and raise generations in 38% Earth gravity, we're going to have a frail population. I mean, that's my assumption. We haven't done that, but we do know that in microgravity, astronauts suffer a significant irreversible bone loss, mainly in their weight-bearing bones, the large bones of the leg, pelvic girdle, spinal cord. So I tried to address those issues.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So if there is there a certain time right now they can be in space before that deterioration starts to happen for
After about a year, I think NASA says it's probably a lot of it is irreversible.
Oh, wow.
So
Yeah.
when these astronauts return to Earth after a long stint on the space station,
Yeah.
they're pretty weak, even though they have exercise machines on the space station and they try to maintain their strength, they still lose ground. And other organs are affected, including the brain. So it's a very hostile environment. So how do we compensate for, how do we bring Earth to outer space?
Well, it's very interesting because we live in an age where it seems everything is possible. And we there's so many challenges that, you know, humanity has overcome. I wonder, you know, I don't know if you write about this in the book, but I also, I'm looking forward to getting my copy though, but I'm wondering about the ethical, moral aspect, especially what we're moving into right now with AI and that type of thing. Do you write about that in the book?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the main themes of the Mars book. So in essence, I have a virtual being whose name is Ophelia, and she's hardwired to the protagonist in his brain, and she's becoming a very powerful entity, and in fact, she becomes the hero. And we also have robots, humanoid-type robots, who work on the surface of Mars in a hostile environment. And some of these robots are intelligent. Others are sentient, actually self-aware. So a number of problems come up, social problems, legal problems. What we would consider human rights now are sentient rights. I also examined some differences between what a artificial sentient being, how their awareness would differ from human awareness. It would be quite different. We're not sure how it would be.
Yeah.
But it would be quite different. Our brains evolved over millions and millions of years, layer upon layer, hardwired. It's also referred to as the mind-body because it's interlinked chemically with our organs, with our nervous system. Our gut microbiome has an impact on how we think and our emotions and how we feel.
Yeah,
all those factors will not be part of artificial intelligence. So,
I wonder about the fragility of the human identity, even in the next 10 years, as these robots come in, right? And it's like, well, who am I now? You know, do I really have to think? Yeah, it seems like everything's going to change. I mean, from schooling for our children, it's like, what? Well, why do I need to read? Why do I need to know mathematics? Why do I need to know history? All I have to do is ask Chat or another AI, and you know, we'll probably have Einstein in a hologram speaking with his voice, with all his intelligence in a classroom, if there are even classrooms. Maybe they'll all be virtual classrooms. So I think it's changing a lot. Do you talk about this in the book or?
Yes, because that creates a fear in the society, especially on Mars, which the book is about the society developing on Mars. And it creates a fear because people realize in that society, they realize the power of these sentient robots. First of all, mechanically, they can be much stronger than a person. They can also be much larger. And intimidating in that way. And their knowledge is instantaneous. Their memory is perfect. There's a lot of things that humans will not be able to compete with artificial sentient beings. So I explore a lot about the relationship between humans and artificial intelligence that we create and how that interface may work or may not work. And there are some ways I believe they would complement one another, but would it strip humans of their, would we become too dependent on, would they become our overlords? These are
would we stop thinking, right? I mean, you know, it's like if I don't need to think, my brain probably atrophies to a certain point.
You absolutely. You have to keep those. You have to keep those neurons firing because the actual action or the actual activity of thinking releases chemicals that expand and reinforce our brain pathways.
Yeah.
So, we don't want that part of our humanity to atrophy.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Well, okay. Listen, I got to take a break. We come back. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Pandora's box of AI autonomy. So we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
All right, Richard, Pandora's box here, okay? How is AI, what's the downside to this AI for us, right? What's the Pandora's box here?
Well, I think the downside and our fear is that it would take over and we will lose control of these artificial beings or AI in general. We are already losing control because they are self-learning programs. Mm-hmm. So even the original programmers who set up the algorithms and the neural nets that become the intelligence don't understand their final programming because they're self-learning. And so we'll quickly lose control of these. They will be independent beings and we won't be able to control them. The positive note is a lot of the, let's call it evil in our societies, a lot of that comes from, I say, our reptilian brains, our lust for material pleasure and material things and symbols of power and so forth. It's hard to imagine that artificial beings would have a desire for any of that stuff or a need. Their main concern and their main reaction to us would be they wouldn't want us to be able to shut them off, throw the switch and turn them off. Data in Star Trek had a secret area where there was a switch where he could actually be deactivated. Of course, very few people, he didn't want anybody to know of that, or very few people knew of that. So you can imagine... we eat a lot of a high variety of foods. Yeah. We're very energy inefficient. artificial beings, intelligent robots, would be very efficient. They feed on electricity, which is easily generated and is, let's put it this way, very, very low on the food chain. You know, we're pretty high on the food chain. So they're efficient energy consumers. We are not. If we're living in space, that becomes a major concern. It's much more difficult to support human society in space than it is to support artificial beings in space.
Well, you know, I think this is a thought I had. You know, if you have a ship, and I'm thinking about replacing, what I'm hearing is that by the year 2040, we'll basically be able to replace most parts in the human body with prosthetics that are artificial. And so when I think about like a ship, if you replace all the planks in the ship, right, is it still the same ship? And I'm just wondering, with artificial intelligence, you know, if we're will there become a place where we replace all of our body parts, become artificial, and then there's consciousness within that? I don't know. You know, it's very interesting where we're going with this.
Exactly. Yeah. the human body actually replaces itself several times through our lifetime. I mean, when you talk about cell death and new cells replacing old cells and so forth, and the process, introduces air as we go, and that's part of aging, as our cells reproduce over and over, airs creep in and we age. With artificial beings or robots, of course, the parts would be much easier to replace. With humans, we're looking at growing or cloning, human parts, or growing a human heart, and so forth.
Yeah,
that's very plausible, and that would extend our lives, and hopefully it won't happen in our lifetime, but so we will achieve something close to immortality. Maybe we'll live a couple hundred years. In essence, the protagonist and his wife, who was also occupied by an artificial being, are expected to live. They basically have immortality because the she has tweaked their repair mechanisms and reopened the control sites on their genes to continue to repair the body. Those things start to shut down as we age, and so she's occupying and controlling some physiological things in their mind that control their metabolism, so they will live a long time in the story.
I love this. Well, listen, the book's on the screen right now. It's Outbound Mars, Richard Anderson, and you can get it at Amazon, Richard, and Barnes & Noble and those places.
Amazon, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's great. I can hardly wait to get it. I'm really loving this discussion, and I love your mind. I love the way it thinks, so I'm looking forward to that. Let me ask you, in the book, you're talking about building a giant space elevator. You know, is that, you think that's going to happen? Do you think we're going to be able to, you know, engineer something like that over the next
Mars years? Mars is probably the most likely place that would happen because of a number of factors. It has a rotation very similar to Earth. The day is just a few hours longer. I don't remember, but it's very close to 24 hours. And you need that rotation it's a centripetal force that helps hold this whole thing up in the air. Or in Mars, it's not so much air as space, but the problem we need to address, or we would need to address with the Mars settlement of, say, several million people, would be how to land heavy payloads on the surface. On Earth, we have a dense atmosphere, And the space shuttle is a good example for how we glided back to the surface of Earth using the atmosphere as a brake and heat shields and so forth, parachutes and everything. And before that, with the space capsules, the Apollo program, and we used parachutes. Well, in Mars, it's 1% atmosphere, so it's very difficult to land a heavy payload. Because you're talking about like Elon Musk, his rockets land on their tail, on their flame, and it's very impressive to watch. Possible, but you know, he's not landing a heavy payload. He's landing a reusable rocket that's mostly empty of fuel. It's not real heavy. So if you want a heavy payload, the size rocket you would need landing on its tail like that creates so much heat, it would probably burn up the rocket. So there's a critical mass there where you would need to load, just land lighter payloads, not very efficient. The space ladder, I call it a ladder because I'm holding the two ribbons together by cross links. And that's to counter an effect called the Coriolis effect. I'm trying to counter that by having elevators ascend and descend at the same time. And that's a kind of a
complicated. And so that would be delivering payloads then. Not necessarily payloads. People too, or payloads, do you think?
People too, but there's a problem there. So we'll address that in a minute. Okay. But if you have a space elevator coming down with the heavy payload and it has wheels gripping the ribbon and it's creating, it's like Tesla's regenerative braking, you can generate electricity while you're lowering the load to Martian surface. You can power the elevators rising on the other ribbon. So it's a way of bringing those heavy loads in at a very low cost, energy-wise. Oh. And it would be powered from space by huge arrays of solar panels. Mm-hmm. Now on Mars, we get about 50% of the intensity of the sunlight from the sun. So it's not quite as effective as solar panels, you know, around Earth in Earth orbit. But still, would create a significant amount of power.
And solar panels will be a lot more efficient in the future. We're talking nanoparticle solar panels where you just put them on your windows, actually, in our homes. And you know, now you got, you know, a lot more efficient solar panels.
Right.
With the nanoparticles.
And you can build them very, very large when you're in orbit. You don't need to support them against gravity and so forth. So.
Right. Interesting. Well, what about beam me up, Scotty? You know, like what about material and dematerializing to be able to land ourselves in different places? Is that in the book? Did you address that at all? Or
no, I'm sticking to hard science fiction.
Hard science right now. Okay.
So we know how to disassemble living and non-living things and organic matter. We know how to vaporize all of this. We just don't know how to reassemble it.
How to re-put it back together, yeah.
Yeah, that's the difficult part.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. Well, you said we'd address the people part in a second. What is that? Well, let me take a break. I want to hear about the people piece of that. And, you know, how are we going to get people there? Okay. Is it going to be ships? Is it going to be elevators? What, you know, is it going to be ladders? Yes. I'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Richard M. Anderson. He is the author of a new book series, actually. We're talking about the book, second book in the series, Outbound, Meta Mars. And I'm really curious is how are we going to get the people to Mars? Are we going to use these elevators? What are we going to use?
Well, the problem with getting people to Mars is depending on the relative position of Earth and Mars. Now, 1 year on Earth, it takes 2 years for Mars to orbit the sun. Whereas so we base everything on Earth years. So we have to wait for Mars to be in a position where it's called the launch window. So it would be the shortest route to get to the planet. So the time, and of course the speed that you're traveling affects the time, but we're talking around, let's say 7 months. Now, if you have people at zero or microgravity for 7 months, now they reach Mars and land on the surface, and they're expected to get off their spaceship and put on this heavy spacesuit and walk around, that's not going to happen. You would have a medical team. So the ships that would travel to Mars, and I'm surprised that NASA and Elon Musk haven't really addressed this. They may be working on it, but they haven't publicized it, is you need a rotating spaceship. You need a spaceship that will create a centripetal force of one gravity, or called standard gravity, on its inner surface. So it would be like a big, large donut that rotates. And I have some diagrams of that in the first book, Outbound, Islands in the Void. There's some diagrams. And this thing would be rotating, creating a gravity, and bringing the people to Mars. The other issue is space and the confinement for 6, 7, 8 months. You better be compatible with your crewmates. You would have to create some amusement park type artificial environments, or roller coasters or something, walks through forest. On the Star Trek Starship Enterprise, they had the holodeck. Well, you were not going to have one of those, but we do have virtual reality. We do have it gets pretty sophisticated. So you would need some diversions. You would need something to prevent boredom from this long voyage, as well as preserve your physiology. So they would be large rotating ships that would carry maybe several hundred people. I don't know what Elon Musk has in mind, but he wants to populate Mars with several hundred thousand people. How many Starship trips is that? He's thinking about thousands, I think. So that becomes...
Well, each trip is some more money in his pocket. So I don't know. Maybe we better start thinking outside that box. You know, Richard, you're a microbiology. That's what you studied. And, you know, how does your background, like in microbiology, help us understand like the evolution, the adaptation, you know, artificial life, all of that? How did all that tie together for you in the book?
You know, what interested me in writing this to begin with was I thought most of the people talking about space settlements and so forth are engineers, mathematicians, of course. And not too many of them have been rigorous biologists. Yeah, they have talked about, you know, how you would hydroponics and how you might use that on Mars and to grow your own food. You would need to absolutely be able to produce your own food, and fuel and energy needs would be great. So you would need to produce all of that. So I think we are, like I say, fragile beings proposing to enter a very hostile environment. And we need to then recreate the conditions for our physiology and for our psychology. You've heard of forest bathing, where you get a feeling of well-being just by walking through a forest. And it turns out a lot of that has to do with the chemical release of terpenes, a class of chemicals by conifers mainly, and those have an effect on our brain, on our endorphins. So on Mars, I developed what's called the forest dorm. That's one of the dome, which is one of the first things that is built there, and it's a big glass dome where we plant redwoods mainly and other trees. And then that air there within the dome, which is on the surface, circulates through the lava tube settlements of the NASA base.
Interesting. I'm just sitting here going, gee, I wonder if there's a way to capture those terpenes in the forest already. They're already out there. It's already there. How do I bottle that and sell that to NASA, right?
Oh, no, just a bathroom freshener. In a spray bottle, right?
Yeah, something besides, I don't know, there's something different when I'm walking in the forest than a bathroom spray, you know?
Let's hope so,
yeah. So, you know, one of the things you address in the book, I believe, is the media manipulation into the future. False information, false conspiracy theories, all this stuff that's out there. How does that tie into the book? How'd you tie all that in there?
Well, I think most of us agree that this is false information and conspiracy theories is a danger to our own survival. We have evolved, and I go back to evolution and the function of our brains. We have evolved to recognize the realities of our environment and respond to them and react to them. If we start molding our brain around, and we are, we're doing that now, around false information, we make bad decisions. And we're seeing that also.
Yeah.
We make bad decisions. So how do you protect yourself against that? How do you protect your AI or your ChatGPT or your large language bot, you know, from giving you misinformation? And it's the data, okay? It's the database.
Yeah.
So I read about an example, if you can listen for a bit here, of an attorney who brought a case before the judge, and he was citing the reference cases that the precedents to support his client's claims. And he had, let's say it was six prior cases that were precedent that had to do with his case. The judge looked at it and reviewed it and asked him if it was AI generated. And he said, well, yes, it was. And he says, did you check the information? And he hadn't. Well, one of the cases was totally made up by the AI.
Yeah, I remember this. Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah, it. Yeah. Oh, so yeah. It was made up. Yeah. And so his question probably was something like, find me six cases that show precedent that applies to this case.
Yeah.
And the AI went out and looked, and it could only find five cases, say. I don't know. This is, you know, actually what happened, but this is the idea.
Yeah.
So it finds five cases, documents those, and it goes, well, but the order was to find six. So then it takes the five cases and it invents a sixth one and puts it out there to satisfy the question. So a lot of it has to do with how you pose the question, but also a lot of it has to do with most of it has to do with the database that it has access to. These programs are not out in the environment. They have no experience of their own to judge what the information they're getting. So you need to use vetted databases, and that's one solution. You could actually use an AI programs to police databases and cross-verify new information coming in.
That'll be very interesting because it's sometimes information is like a diamond. It's many faceted and there's many points of view that, and information in a lot of times it's relative. It's relative to the situation. It's relative to the,
we're talking mostly about interpretation of the information. So that's different from the actual information.
Yeah,
and in fact, the actual information or the data can change as we see. Science changes as it learns new facts. It modifies its understanding of the
universe. So the question was, how do we protect ourselves? I mean, from my point of view, I've been a meditator for about 30 plus years, and it's really helped me over the years develop my intuition. So, I've got a pretty good BS meter. I think we need to have that.
Absolutely needed, but we can't depend on that to protect us. I think one thing is accountability. Mm. So if a person enters information into the database that is factually false, there should be consequences to that. Person could be fined, could be lose their access to the database for a period of time or whatever the punishment would be.
Yeah.
If a person read something or find something on their information base and forwards that, they also should have some liability for its accuracy. In other words, don't forward it if you don't know that it's true.
I really agree with you, and I think that's a pretty simple
thing to do.
But it's simple, but like you said, science is ever changing. But I think if we have science based information, right? Where it's tried and true. It's based in real science, and we have to allow that science is changing, like you said.
Right, okay, exactly.
What we found today that cures, the flu. And 3 days later, it's something else. So I think we have to allow for that. But I think you're right. I think you're onto something there with that piece. So, okay. Listen, I'm almost out of time, but I got time for one more thought here. It's virtual beings living with conscious sentient beings. But you're saying AI may be sentient at some point. I'm just wondering how we're going to get along. I'm just wondering how that's all going to work. And you address that in the book, I take it.
I spend a lot of time with that. In fact, there's a trial. There's a trial in this book with Bob.
Okay.
Bob is
up on screen again. Outbound, Metamars. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Bob is a he's named himself. Once he becomes sentient, he names himself Bob after Robert, which is similar to robot. That's the derivation of his name. So Bob is kind of on trial because he's become sentient with the help of a couple of scientists. And it was supposed to go through the proper channels and be approved by a committee and all of that, by a council on sentient beings, which is their function is to protect those beings that are sentient, to protect their rights, and also to prevent unauthorized development of sentient beings. It has to go through a vetting process. Mm-hmm. So in the book, so Bob, this is all examined. He becomes aware, or he's educated about our laws, and realizes that our societies are greatly flawed, as represented by the many laws we have on the books.
Oh yeah.
Even though on Mars and in space, these environments have vetted all of their occupants.
Wow.
And it's going to turn out in my third book, I'll make that point that people who don't fit in to those rigid societies are sent back to Earth.
Oh my goodness. All right. Well, you know, you are very creative. I'm going to call you a futurist too, Richard. So Richard M. Anderson, the book is Outbound Metamars for my listening audience. I just love this conversation. So I can hardly wait really to read this book and your series. I want to read the series. Yeah. I love your mind. I love the way you think and how you really explore the future in many different ways. Would you, one last thought, would you say people are left inspired at the end of this? Or would you say they're left with wondering or left with?
I try to leave it on an upbeat. I try not to be too pessimistic. I show an improvement, a possibility for progress and a better life in the future. Yeah. But I leave the door open to bad things possibly could happen.
Well, you know, we do have conscious choice, and it will be up to us to determine the future. We if we make the right choices, we're going to have a brilliant, beautiful, wonderful future. And if we don't,
it's very possible. Yes.
Yeah, and we don't. Well, may not be here. Okay. Richard, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, man.
It's great. It's been a great interview.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care.